form.
BATF IRS CIA and FBI FDA and FCC ADL and KGB
Welcome, 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 everybody. Pastor Eli James and Michael Swede here on Eurofolk Radio, simulcasting on Speak Free Radio. And today we've got a whale of a show, lots of information, plenty of announcements that are going to be relevant to the show today. Especially, we're going to be talking about the Genocide Convention and how we as white people can use the Genocide Convention against our enemies because they are trying to destroy our culture. And that's blatantly obvious that they're trying to destroy white culture. And we can use the Genocide Convention in our own defense. So how are you doing this morning, Michael?
Yeah, I'm doing good. But I'm a bit upset over the fact that now Sweden has joined NATO, so that makes me a bit upset. But regardless of that, I am happy. I'm in a good mood. And how can we not be in good mood when we have Yahweh on our side? So Amen. Nothing to fear, really.
Right, right. Well, so maybe they'll want to draft you into a war, right? Which they couldn't have done before.
For sure. Oi, Sweden's last war, was it the 1850s, something like this? It's over 200 years ago.
Yeah, Sweden is just a warmonger nation, right?
Must be,
because you're white. Sweden is white, therefore it's evil, right? And what Joe Biden said, he said, white people are evil. we have to get rid of white people. Genocide convention, folks. Yeah, this is even such statements are a violation of the Genocide Convention, as we will find out shortly, because we're going to be talking about that. Yeah. So let me make a bunch of announcements real quick. First of all, Brother Hebert's shows are now on Brighteon, and I think he'll put a link in the chat room shortly, and I'll get the exact link for you and announce it as well. The calendars for this year are ready. Brother Hebert has those ready, and they can be purchased from American National Publishing for $20. Send $20 to ANP. You can make the a check out to ANP. Post Office Box 3192, Harrison, Arkansas, 72601. Again, that's $20 to ANP. Post Office Box 3192, Harrison, Arkansas, 72601. Okay, so the calendars are ready. Brother Hebert is on Brighteon. We're expanding our horizons, folks. And there's plans in the works for these shows, both on Eurofolk Radio and Speak Free Radio, to be broadcast simultaneously on various other platforms. So we're looking forward to that. So, and then as Michael said, we'll talk about Sweden joining NATO and what the implications are about that shortly. But and then we'll be talking about the Genocide Convention. And I just want to announce that the show I did on the Pale of Settlement last night on Restoration Hour has been uploaded. And that's a really good, the article I was reading from was really good, explaining how the Jews were kind of like being kicked around like a soccer ball by various nations. Oh, no, it's actually more like a hot potato, Michael. Right. You don't want to catch this hot potato. It will burn your hands. And that's what's happened with the Jews all over Europe, burning the hands of the nations that fell into their laps. A horrible situation, very well explained by the author of that article. Okay.
And unfortunately, this hot potato is going to many different hot pieces that's landed in most, in your nation. You got a big lump of that potato, unfortunately.
Yeah. It's in my lap and it burns. It burns. Right? Oh, no. Yeah. I'll never be able to have children again. All right. Today on Voice of Christian Israel, Ted Midward and I are going to be discussing the Civil War chapters of Andy's book, Synagogue of Satan. And he goes into great detail on how the Rothschilds orchestrated the Civil War. I see there's already comments in the chat room about the Civil War and Lincoln. And then, and really quickly, because yesterday we had an event in Springfield, Missouri, where my friend Daryl McClanahan was present. And number one, he's got a lawsuit against the ADL, the Anti-Dissent League, which tries to suppress dissent against Jews worldwide, but especially here in America, which is a total violation of First Amendment freedom of speech. Nevertheless, they have so much corrupting influence in our government that they are getting away with preventing us from speaking our minds about the Jewish question. That's the whole purpose of the ADL. And so we talked about that, and he's also running for governor in the state of Missouri. And so, just Google his name, Daryl McClanahan, and you'll find out how things are going for him. He needs support. He needs to broadcast the cause that his cause is supporting white people against the enemies that we have. And so he filed a lawsuit against the ADL. And would you believe, Michael? The ADL offered him $150,000payoff to drop the lawsuit.
Ooh, then you are above the target. Then you have accomplished something if you want to buy you out of this.
Yeah, and he said no. I want to clear my name. The ADL called him a racist. Okay, and that's on the basis of several shows he's done here on Eurofolk Radio. A regular guest of mine on the Restoration Hour in several years past. But the problem with that accusation is that on our shows, we fought injustice against all people of all colors and all races. We supported this black guy who was getting white all people out of their fake mortgages. And he was being persecuted by the regime for exposing all these fake mortgages. He was doing good. And so we supported this black guy. So come on, ADL. You can't be accusing us of racism when we support a black guy. And then also this the Jewish reporter who was beaten up and I think even shot by a Missouri cop because he was exposing corruption in the state of Missouri. And so we were supporting him too. Wherever injustice is, Eurofolk Radio is there to expose it, right? It doesn't matter what the color of your skin. If you're a victim of injustice, if they do it to a black person or to a Jew or to a Mexican, they can do it to you, okay? We oppose all injustice against all people. We want a just and righteous world, right? Isn't that what we want?
Yeah, it should be justice for everybody. It should be justice. But unfortunately, it's always we, the white people, that have the short straw in this, and the Jews often get away with it. And often it is the big, rich Jews that are getting away with it. You have the smaller one. They're just pawns in the game. To quote a famous book, they've written about this. They are mostly pawns in the game. And that is what is said in the Protocols of Learning of Zion, that they are just pawns in the game that they use for cannon fodder to make people believe there is something called anti-Semitism, but it is not. And that word is also an oxymoron. So,
yeah, and the ultra-rich Jews, the Oberjuden, as the Germans correctly refer to them, the big-shot, power-broking Jews, will sacrifice their own people at the drop of a hat, and they will use a stage an event where they've even admitted there's a term in the Israeli state. There's a term for it. I forget. Yeah, I reported on it last week. Anyway, they have a term for sacrificing their own people, you know, deliberately. Okay, they have a term for it. And so it's becoming common knowledge that this is what the Israelis do, the big shot Jews will sacrifice their own people for political advantage. Now, who would do such a thing, Michael? Who would do such a thing? Oh, Nero did that too, right? Or he said he burned Rome and blamed the Christians.
Yeah, what I say, false flag, you almost call it. I don't know what to call it.
Yeah, a false flag. But when these false flags, you sacrifice your own people for, how should I put it, propaganda value.
Yeah, and that is too sick. That is very sick.
It is sick. It is very sick. But that's what the Jews do. These things need to be exposed, folks. All right, so let's, update on Daryl McClanahan again. Search for his name, and he's trending. He's getting tremendous press, most of it, of course, negative because the press is owned by the Jews. But nevertheless, he's hanging in there, and I'll give him as much help as I can on my end so that he has a fighting chance. Now, the interesting thing is his campaign may succeed, at least in terms of he's already on the ballot. Okay, they're going to try to remove him from the ballot because he's a supposed racist, right? And so, but that's not going to succeed because of the reasons I just gave you. You know, because we support injustice, fighting injustice against all people, no matter what the color of their skin or their background. We are opposed to injustice. Okay, so they really can't. They're going to have to back off on that one because it's false, and they know it's false. That's why they offered him $150,000 to drop the charges. He filed a lawsuit against them. Okay? So that's a really good indication that the ADL knows they made a mistake. Right? They know they made a mistake. So this is going to get very, very interesting, folks. So Daryl McClanahan, please support him to the what extent you can. All right, so now let's get into the genocide. Oh, no, well, you have more reporting on the situation in Sweden. Go ahead. Okay.
Yes, I have an article, a short article that I can just read out of that is telling about this. It's a very short one. It's from the National Socialist homepage. It's a short one, but let's read it.
Okay.
It's globalism. Sweden formally joined NATO on Thursday, and on Monday, the Swedish flag will be raised for the first time outside NATO headquarters in Brussels. During the day, Prime Minister Ulf Kristersson and Foreign Minister Tobias Billström are in Washington to hand over what is left of Sweden's sovereignty to the transatlantic alliance NATO. At the same time, government representatives held a press conference in Stockholm. This is a very beautiful day in a very dangerous world. Liberal Party leader Johan Persson at the press conference. As a member of NATO, we will be covered by NATO's binding SEC defense guarantee, added Defense Minister Paul Jonsson. Jonsson also claims that NATO now means that we no longer have to defend Sweden alone. Aiding, we will defend Sweden also outside Sweden in the future. We belong with the free democracies of the West, said Deputy Prime Minister Ebba Busch at the press conference. At 1700 hours, the Prime Minister signed Sweden's instrument of accession to NATO at the Swedish embassy in Washington. And 30 minutes later, Kristensson handed the document to U.S. Jewish Secretary of State Anthony Blinken, making the formal accession of Sweden to NATO.
Wow. There it is. Okay. Yeah. Again, there has to be a Jew in the middle. All right. Anthony Blinken, U.S. Secretary of State. Okay. Right. There's nothing happens on the world stage without the Jews either directing it or being involved behind the scenes. Okay. There's nothing.
I agree.
It's all orchestrated. Yeah. It's all orchestrated by them.
Yeah, so, and I can also add, those two people I mentioned, all the one in the Swedish parliament, are just traitors. They are traitors, and yes, they should be prosecuted as traitor, because now they're giving away the loss of Sweden's sovereignty to a foreign state. And I also posted it in the chat room, this picture of this when they're handing it over, this sick two traitors that should be hung for what they have done.
Right, yeah. So I think the most we can say at this point in time, Michael, is that more and more patriots, that those you know, so Swedes, Germans, Americans, Danes, etc., Brits, who understand that our nations are under assault by globalism. That number of people who understand this is increasing by the day. Now, it's just a question, but there's so much corruption at the top of our governments that extracting, you need a crowbar to extract every little stinking Jew who is directing all of this corruption from behind the scenes. But fortunately, Jacob Rothschild has died, and that's going to leave a power vacuum, you know, because typically what happens is when you have a sinister force like Jacob Rothschild disappear, his sons and daughters will not be as, let's say, you know, brutal as their daddy, okay? And a lot of the children are actually more interested in partying than in ruling the world from behind the scenes. So the power system created by the Rothschilds is beginning to dissipate. And you may see dissension within the ranks, as we are seeing in the Israeli state. The Israeli state is tearing itself apart with all this factionalism that's going on, and with Netanyahu blatantly genociding the Palestinian people in Gaza. This is creating a worldwide reaction. I don't think the Israeli state is going to recover. I think it's starting to fall apart. What do you think?
Yeah, that's because Mr. Babylon will also burn. But I don't know. Isn't it now we had this Alpha Jew Rothschild that has been ruling the world since the Napoleonic War, when they defeat Napoleon. But then, yes, don't you think there could be another Alpha Jew lurking in the dark that wants to try to take over?
Yeah, there might be, but the tendency is, you know, as even in the mafia family, right, the sons and daughters aren't as vicious as the founders of the mafia, right? They're just not as vicious as their parents. So the Jacob Rothschild, I think, is the last of the breed. So we'll see what happens. And we need to keep reporting on this and see, you know, if there's any breaks in the dike of Rothschildism had in the future. We need to throw a monkey wrench in the gears of Rothschildism to whatever extent. But you know, if we continue to expose this, more and more people will wake up, and people are waking up to the fact that the world government is an evil enterprise, totally evil enterprise.
Eli, maybe you said that. Who do you think will take over? Is it his son, this one that is in Switzerland, this business, I don't remember his name now. Is this the one that will probably take over the family? Because it should be someone that is older than him, I guess, around, or right. I don't know.
Yeah, well, you mean that hippie?
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Yeah, that's a really good question. As I said, I don't think there's anybody in line who is as vicious as Jacob Rothschild was, okay? So how are they going to manage the Rothschild? For number one, they have to focus also on managing the Rothschild fortune. You know, the various corporations they control. They control mass media. They control the news services, Reuters, Associated Press International, UPI. They control all of that stuff. So they have to make sure they maintain control of it. And whenever a mafia boss dies, there's always somebody in the wings, you know, waiting to take over, somebody you don't expect. So we'll see what happens. Okay, this is going to get very interesting, folks. Major development, actually. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, like you had in the picture, you have it on the homepage, this with Pope Francis singing for Lucifer. You have this one, James de Rothschild. I guess he is from the French House of Rothschild.
Right, right, yeah. And so, but not all of the Rothschild branches are doing as well as the Bank of England. You know, Bank of England has always been top dog. And, we'll see if, I think they're going to survive in England, but they might not do as well. You know, for example, France is in a riotous condition, you know, and Macron, the Jew bankster that the Rothschilds installed to rule over France, he is not popular at all. You know, the French people hate his guts. So you never know. There might be an insurrection here, an insurrection, a real insurrection, right? Not just the January 6th nonsense. I have to announce, I posted an update on the January 6th, 2021 supposed insurrection and what was really happening there. It was actually a peaceful protest where, you know, the Patriots were taking a stroll through the Capitol because the Capitol Police invited them in, right? And the Supreme Court reportedly is going to overturn a lot of these convictions because, number one, Michael, the word insurrection is undefined in the law. So what is an insurrection?
Oh, now it's the word. What's the word first mean? Because insurrection is like an overtake or something like that.
Yeah, try to overthrow the government. There was nothing of the kind happening at that point. Even if they attacked the Capitol building, doesn't mean they were trying to overthrow the government. Right?
No, that was all stage. So, I mean, that was phony.
Yeah. Right, yeah. Well, like I said, the Capitol Police allowed them to come in, right? So the whole thing is fake. The whole episode is fake, and it may become unglued very shortly. If the Supreme Court overturns a number of these convictions, then the American people will become aware of how fake all of these charges are and how it was actually staged by the government, not by patriots, folks. This is the illusion that the Rothschilds have created for us to follow is coming apart at the seams. It is, okay? It's just a question of how fast will our people wake up? That's the question. Okay, and then Mary says in the chat room, that the Nathaniel is the only son of Jacob. So I don't know what kind of power, what position Nathaniel holds, but then you have all the other relatives. And the research I've been doing in recent years about the Rothschild family is most of them are just interested in partying and maintaining their personal fortunes, not ruling the world. Okay? Ruling the world is touchy stuff. Right? It may get you assassinated. All right? So this is getting interesting, folks. It's getting very, very interesting. So, yeah, we'll have to do some research on Nathaniel and see where his head is at, okay? All right. So let's get into it, okay? So let's talk now about the Genocide Convention and how the Genocide Convention is actually in our favor as white people. So I put the link in the chat room, folks. This is from the United Nations way back in 1948, 9 December 1948, Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide. Now, this was put in place, Michael and listeners, for the benefit of the Jews because of the supposed Holocaust, that the Jewish people were being attacked as a people in various ways, supposedly. But however, it does not identify the ethnic personality of the people involved. So, Michael, if you want to go ahead and read, and I'll comment, entry to force, 12 January 1951, in accordance with Article 13. And I would have to say, first of all, the United Nations is a phony organization established by the Rothschilds, okay, of course. Okay, but nevertheless, as long as nations agree to the terms of the convention, then they give it legal force, even though it's really illegal because nobody ever elected any official of the United Nations. They're an unelected body, just as NATO is. NATO is an unelected body. It's just a bunch of bureaucrats hired by the Rothschilds to do their bidding. But nevertheless, as long as nations and judges agree that this has some kind of legal force, then you can file suit against anybody who is committing genocide against your people, Michael. You can do this. All right. I'll just quote the introduction here. The contracting parties, having considered the declaration made by the General Assembly of the United Nations in its Resolution 96I, dated 11 December 1946, that genocide is a crime under international law, contrary to the spirit and aims of the United Nations and condemned by the civilized world. Okay, we can agree with that. Recognizing that at all periods of history, genocide has inflicted great losses on humanity, comma, and being convinced that in order to liberate mankind from such an odious scourge, international cooperation is required, hereby agree as hereinafter provided. Okay, so one quick question before we even get started. Has the United Nations prevented genocide?
No.
No.
They are making, they are creating genocide, not just here.
That's
also
right.
When they have, I guess, was it when they sent in Jewish troops into, was it Haiti? Or where was it? When they have armed soldiers running in without of having medics with them and shooting people, shooting civilian people on the streets.
Right. Yeah, yeah. No, the United Nations is totally phony. Has never prevented genocide. In fact, has promoted communism throughout its continuing existence. So, and communism itself is a form of genocide against white people. So, but nevertheless, this statement against genocide exists in the United Nations document, and you know, we need to exploit it. We need to use it in our favor. And you know, we need to talk to some lawyers. How do we get Joe Biden to stop saying that white people are evil and need to be eliminated? Because when he makes statements like that, he is violating this genocide convention, folks. He is. All right, over to you.
Yeah, let's read this and see if the Jews are putting in loopholes here.
Right.
You know, I'm a bit right. Wary about this kind of stuff here. They are loopholes.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it's legalese, isn't it? Legalese by Jewish lawyers.
Yeah. So, Article 1. The contracting parties confirm that genocide, whether committed in time of peace or in time of war, is a crime under international law, which they undertake to prevent and to punish. Okay, yeah, we can agree with that. But
yeah.
But they doesn't do anything to prevent or to punish it. I'm not seeing that.
Yeah, they haven't really enforced this provision, so let's make them enforce it. Okay? By stopping the genocide of white people. Okay. Oh, how about stopping the genocide of Palestinians?
Yeah, that too. They all are getting genocided.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. Article 2. In the present convention, genocide means any of the following acts committed with intent to destroy, in whole or in part, a national, ethnical, racial, or religious group. As such.
Now, that's pretty broad. That's really broad, okay? So, are white people a racial group, ethnic group, national group? You know, how about white people in Sweden? Aren't they an ethnic national group?
Yeah, they are, and also in some kind of religious group also.
And if you make them feel guilty about being white, let's enumerate these five clauses here.
Yeah, so A, killing members of the group.
Okay, that's obvious. We can all agree that's genocide. Okay.
Yeah. B, causing serious bodily or mental harm to member of the group.
Oh, now that one's interesting. Okay. B, because what's mental harm is telling white people that they're evil and guilty of all of the crimes of the universe. Isn't that causing mental harm to white people?
Yeah, I'm also thinking about brainwashing. Isn't that also mental harm?
There you go. Absolutely. Okay, you can see how this genocide convention is in our favor, folks. Please continue.
C, deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part.
Yeah, by blaming us and calling us all evil and that therefore we do not deserve to live. But this applies even more to the Palestinians. And obviously, the UN has not seen fit to accuse the Israeli state of genocide against the Palestinian people, which, by all right, it should do. All right?
Yeah. And what I think about this, deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of a life calculated to bring about physical destruction in the whole part. Isn't feminism one part of that?
That's an interesting question. Yeah, well, okay. Please elaborate. Because
feminism has created so that women now, they instead of before time when, I don't know, the 50s, 60s, 70s, there were one mate for everybody. You had as many male as female. And then they all had someone on the different tier. But now today, now the women's court of feminism, they will only hunt for the 20% in the upper top. And you know, you have a lot of guys that stands without. And look at our birth rate. There are 1.2 children per female. We need to have 2.1 to even sustain. So that's how I would regard as feminist as one of those tools.
So aside from the fact that the feminists in themselves are evil, right, they're preventing the birth rate of the white race.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, what about homosexuals?
Yeah, for sure. That's not using the body you have received from Yahweh God in a proper manner, using the sexual, what do you say, tools in a manner that is not what he intended it to be.
Now, hasn't the United Nations promoted both of these activities?
Oh, yeah. May have.
Okay. Right. Yeah. I mean, if we brought suit on the articles of the Genocide Convention here, I mean, the United Nations would seriously look horrible. And, of course, the people who created it. All right. Please continue.
And D, this is also imposing measures intended to prevent birth within the group.
Oh, there you go. Wow. Wow. I mean, the left is doing this all over the world.
Yeah, they are. Okay. Abortion.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Is one. Then we have all the other one. What do you call it? Pia pillar. You know, the pillars that the women eat so they don't get pregnant.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Yeah. Birth control pillars. All the other prevention methods. And those methods are all aiming toward white people.
That's right. That's right. But even if they're aimed at blacks and others, the pill has very negative health effects for women. Okay. And, but the doctors never tell the women, oh, well, this might make you infertile. Okay. For the rest of your life and you won't be able to have babies. Oh, really? Oh, they never told me that, right? Before they dispensed the pill, they never. And I think cancer and other complications can result from the birth control pill. All right, but here, I mean, this language is in our favor. We can use it against the establishment. Please continue.
E, forcibly transferring children of the group to another group.
Okay. Oh, how about... child trafficking.
Yeah.
Child trafficking, folks.
That is one. And then you have the other one that the governments use when they are breaking the families, when they're taking the children away from their parents because the right. parents haven't raised them as good little communists. They have not been receiving vaccines. They have not been looking at TV all the time. So then that's not good for the children, so they take them away. That is typical Sweden, what the Swedish governments do when they are not raised as good little communists.
Yes, right. That's right. And that's what the United Nations is. It's good little communists. But when they wrote this genocide convention, they didn't realize because they wrote it in the aftermath of World War II, and it was written to prevent, quote unquote, genocide against Jews. That's what the intention was. But hey, yeah. We're people too, aren't we? Right? We can be genocided. Yeah, yeah. And Mr. Kim Smith says homosexuals should be killed. Well, of course, the United Nations is not interested in Leviticus, but the fact that homosexuality does prevent births of people because let's put it this way, very simply, anal intercourse does not produce children; it produces disease. Okay, it produces disease. And Swamp Fox says. The Jewish Kahila is the international Jewish network that governs the political destiny of most of the world. At the top of the satanic organization sits one man known as the King of the Jews, who is the worldwide leader of world. The Rothschild family is just out the front part. Yeah, well, there is a rabbi, and I forget what the name, I think Exilarch is the name of that person known as the King of the Jews. There's two offices. I forget the other. One is Exilarch. And which is the ruler of the Jews in the outside of Jerusalem, okay? And then there's some rabbi who probably lives in Israel who is the official rabbi of the Jews the worldwide, okay? These people are not named, okay? So Judaism is a secret society. You know, that's the most we can say about that. All right, back to you, Michael.
Yeah, for sure it is. Let's see, where I'll take the article there. Article 3. The following act shall be punishable. Shall be punishable. Okay.
Okay. A,
genocide. Yeah, we have spoken about the genocidal methods above. B, conspiracy to commit genocide.
Oh, all the anti-white rhetoric that we've been experiencing for the last, 30 years? Who's behind that? Who has conspired to create all this rhetoric?
All right.
Yes, there you go.
C, direct and public incitement to commit genocide.
Oh, isn't that happening all the time? White people are evil. You know, we have Jews saying whiteness must be eliminated. All kinds of Jews saying that, right? Direct and public incitement to commit genocide.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
D, attempt to commit genocide.
All right, they're succeeding, aren't they?
They are. E, complicity in genocide.
Oh, all the politicians. Yeah, all the politicians. Right, Democrats and Republicans alike. Okay,
yeah,
we need to enforce this genocide convention, folks. We need to enforce it. Back to you, Michael.
Yeah, exactly. And the funny part is that, when you see all of this, everything of this they are doing. I mean, they're not attempting to commit genocide.
They're doing it, yeah.
But then, now this is a stupid question from my side. When can you say it is a genocide? When do you have a certain number of numbers should be, disappear to say there's a genocide, or should it be? Maybe I'm overthinking here, but is there any? One people is dying. Yeah, that's a tragedy. But when can you say it is a genocide? When has it turned over to a genocide?
Well, I mean, obviously, the invasion of white Europe, you know, financed by the Rothschilds of non-white peoples with rape and murder, and how should I put this? Turning the culture of Europe into a non-white culture, as Barbara Lerner Specter said, must happen, right? That's genocide. according to his definitions. Okay.
Yeah, and she also said that the Jew will be resented for all this.
That's right, and they will be. More and more people are figuring this out. Okay.
They are, and that's Okay, let's take Article 4. Persons committing genocide or any of the other acts enumerated in Article 3 shall be punished, whether they are consistently responsible rulers, public officials, or private individuals.
Okay, well, I would like to see that enforced, right? I mean, first off, what the Jews have done to the Palestinian people is, by all standards, genocide.
Oh.
Okay. And, you know, since we're going to be talking about the Balfour Declaration as our main article, that's so blatantly obvious that it can't be debated, right? So the last thing the United Nations wants is for somebody to bring charges of genocide against the people who are committing it, like namely the Israeli state and the Democratic Party blatantly trying to abolish whiteness. Okay. So, but I think the chances of, you know, any kind of lawsuit prevailing in Israel are extremely remote. However, if we can organize a white anti-genocide campaign and bring charges under the Genocide Convention, this would make the Rothschilds extremely uncomfortable, right? Extremely uncomfortable. All right, back to you.
And now, does this Rothschild, a new one, Nathalie, the fifth Baron of Rothschild, does he care as much, you think? Is he is just partying? I don't know.
Maybe he's a toker and a partier. You know, maybe he doesn't want the responsibility. I mean, you know, the responsibility for running the whole world from London, that's huge. It's huge. Has he got the stomach for it? We'll find out.
Yeah, okay. Let's take Article 5 then. The contracting parties undertake to enact, in accordance with their respective constitutions, the necessary legislations to give effects to the provisions of the present convention and, in particular, to provide effective penalties for persons guilty of genocide or any of the other acts enumerated in Article 3.
Now, of course, I don't think the United Nations has ever, you know, prosecute anybody under this convention. It's about time they do. And we know who should be prosecuted. Back to you.
Yes. Article 6. Persons charged with the genocide or any of the other acts enumerated in Article 3 shall be tried by a competent tribunal of the state in the territory of which the act was committed, or by such international penal tribunal as may have jurisdiction with respect to those contracting parties which shall have accepted its jurisdiction.
Oh. Okay. Can't wait. I can't wait for such a tribunal to be formed.
Yeah. So you should have one in every state, state. You should have one in every white state for this.
Amen. Amen.
Yeah. Okay, Article 7. Genocide and the other acts enumerated in Article 3 shall not be considered as political crimes for the purpose of extradition. The contracting parties pledge themselves in such cases to grant extradition in accordance with their laws and treaties in force.
Okay, so how do you extradite? Do you need to extradite the Rothschilds from the city of London to hold a trial? I don't think that's necessary. You can hold a trial in England. Okay. Yeah, but maybe we should. Maybe they should be extradited to South Africa where they're not so popular. All right, back to you.
What they say? I mean, they say that shall not be considered as political crimes for the purpose of extradition. Okay, for the purpose of taking. Okay, that you have to take them and put them into charges in other nations. Okay.
Yeah. Well, what about what? Who is the Australian guy who has been living in London because he exposed all of the evil activities of the U.S. military? What's his name now? I can't think of his name. Anyway, yeah, you had it. Maybe
no,
somebody
no,
in the chat
it, it's not not Snowden. The other one.
Yeah, well, he's a good example too.
Julian Assange.
Yeah, Julian. Right. Yeah, and so. Haven't they been extradited from one country to another? I mean, just for exposing the crimes of the U.S. military, right? I mean, are you not permitted to expose criminality?
Apparently
right?
not.
No, apparently not. All right, yeah, please continue.
And this one could be a bit more maybe tricky. Article 8. Any contracting party may call upon the competent organs of the United Nations to take such action under the Charter of the United Nations as they consider appropriate for the prevention and suppression of acts of genocide or any of the other acts enumerated in Article 3.
Okay. Any contracting party would be any member nation who has agreed to the terms of the United Nations, such as Sweden. Such as America, such as Canada, Australia, etc. So one of the contracting parties has to initiate the legal action, okay? And can we find a politician in America, and certainly Joe Biden would not be a good – do you think maybe Trump, if he gets reelected, could initiate such an action? Do you think he'd be inclined to do so, Michael?
No, I don't think he is, because I think he is Jewish.
So. Right.
He's Jewish.
Right. Yeah. Now, is an individual able to file charges under this convention? I think, that's a good legal question. All right, back to you.
Yeah, that's what you need, and that's probably one of the loopholes you need to find. Hopefully, they're not close to that one.
Right. Yeah.
Article 9, disputes between the contracting parties relating to the interpretation, application, or fulfillment of the present convention, including those relating to the responsibility of a state of genocide, or for any of the other acts enumerated in Article 3, shall be submitted to the International Court of Justice at the request of any of the parties to the dispute.
Okay, so we need to find somebody willing to put this before the court. Next.
Yes, okay, Article 10. The present convention of which the Chinese, English, French, Russian, and Spanish texts are equally authentic shall bear the date of 9th of December 1948.
Okay, so it's been around since 9 December 1948, but it has never been invoked, folks. Never. All right. Please continue.
Article 11. The present convention shall be open until 31st of December 1949 for signature on behalf of any member of the United Nations and of any non-member state to which an invitation to sign has been addressed by the General Assembly. The present convention shall be ratified, and the instrument of ratification shall be deposited with the Secretary of State of the United Nations.
Blah, blah, blah. All right. Okay, finish this article, and then I need to take a break. So, yeah, we'll take a pause right after this.
After 1st of January 1950, the present convention may be assented to on behalf of any member of the United Nations and of any non-member state which has received an invitation as aforesaid. Instrument of ascension shall be deposited with the Secretary General of the United Nations.
All right, very good. Okay, so let's play. Okay, here we go. Come on. What's happening? It's not playing. Let's try different. Let's try My Dear Messiah. Let's try that. Okay. Very slow and uploading here. There we go. All right. 5 minutes. Folks, welcome back, and I'm going to just quickly announce that Money Tree Publishing is the sponsor of Speak Free Radio. It has a lot of good audios, videos, and books. Europa, The Last Battle, In Black and White, a conversation between Dave Geheri and the black author about the Jews, the myth of German villainy, Mein Kampf, and Henry Ford's The International Jew, The War Against Whites by Arthur Kemp, Jews Are the Problem, some fantastic titles here. Of course, my book, The Great Impersonation, and Exposing the Lies of History. And I'm still waiting for Andrew Carrington Hitchcock's The New World Order, Communism by the Back Door. Really great stuff. The Greatest Story Never Told, Hellstorm. The Truth and History, folks, Exploding the Middle East Myths, The Host and the Parasite, another great title, In the Name of Yahweh by Andrew Carrington Hitchcock, and, of course, The Synagogue of Satan, which we will be talking about. We'll be quoting the Synagogue of Satan, the Civil War chapters, later today on Voice of Christian Israel. So by all means, take advantage and take a look at what Money Tree Publishing has available for you. All right, folks, let's get back into today's subject. And back to you, Michael.
Yeah, thank you. So let's continue then with now Article 12. Any contracting party may at any time by notification addressed to the Secretary General of the United Nations extend the application of the present convention to all or any of the territories or for the conduct of whose foreign relations that contracting parties is responsible. Bah, sorry for my bad when I'm butchering this legalistic words here.
Right. Okay.
So, Article 13. On the day when the first 20 instruments of ratification of accession have been deposited, the Secretary General shall draw up a process verbal and transmit a copy thereof to each member of the United Nations and to each of the non-member state contemplated in Article 11. The present convention shall come into force on the 9th day following the date of deposit of the 20th instrument of ratification or accession. Any ratification or accession effected subsequent to the latter date shall become effective on the ninth day following the deposit of the instrument of ratification or accession. Blah blah blah.
Most of these remaining articles are blah blah. Right, technicalities not relevant to what actually defines genocide. But let's see how many more are left here.
Do you want to read on the last one now? So we don't.
Yeah,
we don't,
okay.
Because we have to seize and not to use a putting a loophole here that makes it that only we cannot apply or something like that, you know.
Yeah, if you can catch a Jew in a loophole, that's fantastic. All right. So I'll just read through these quickly because they're very much technical, about timing when the convention is supposed to be applicable, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, so Article 14. The present convention shall remain in effect for a period of 10 years, as from the date of its coming into force. It shall thereafter remain in force for successive periods of 5 years for such contracting parties as have not denounced it at least 6 months before the expiration of the current period. So who would want to denounce activity against genocide? Right? So as far as I can tell, it's still in effect. All right. Denunciation shall be effected by a written notification addressed to the Secretary General of the United Nations. Now, who would want to denounce, punishment of genocide? Article 15. If, as a result of denunciations, the number of parties to the present convention should become less than 16, the convention shall cease to be enforced from the date on which the last of these denunciations shall become effective. Now, very interesting that this is even included. Anyway, Article 16, a request for the revision of the present convention may be made at any time by any contracting party by means of a notification in writing addressed to the Secretary General. The General Assembly shall decide upon the steps, if any, to be taken in respect to such requests. Okay, so as far as I know, Michael, the Genocide Convention is still in effect. Article 17. The Secretary General of the United Nations shall notify all members of the United Nations and the non-member states contemplated in Article 11 of the following: A, signatures, ratifications, and accessions received in accordance with Article 11. B, notifications received in accordance with Article 12. C, the date upon which the present convention comes into force in accordance with Article 13. D, denunciations received in accordance with Article 14. Now, I'm wondering if any kind of denunciation has ever been received. Who would want to denounce punishment of genocide? E, maybe the Israelis. The abrogation of the convention in accordance with Article 15. F, notifications received in accordance with Article 16. Any interesting comment from you on this provision here? It's obviously legalese, but you know, as far as we can tell, the Convention on Genocide still holds. All right, and the U.S. is a contracting member, so if the U.S. government decides, they can enforce this. All right. Anyway, okay. Article 18. The original of the present convention shall be deposited in the archives of the United Nations. That's in New York City, folks. A certified copy of the convention shall be transmitted to each member of the United Nations and to each of the non-member states contemplated in Article 11. So every nation would have a copy of this on file. Article 19, the last one. The present convention shall be registered by the Secretary General of the United Nations on the date of its coming into force. Okay, all official technical stuff, let's file this, let's file that. But the wording of the convention is contained mainly in the first, I think, about 9 or 10 articles. But the important thing is the definitions of genocide contained in Article 3. That's the really important one, which includes such thing as mental harm, folks. Mental harm against a particular people or race. So let's go for it. Let's prosecute the genociders in the world. All right. Okay. Any comments before we go on to our main article, Michael?
No, but that's every point there is exactly what the Jews are. When we discuss those 3 points or 4 points, we can find that the Jews use every one of those points against us. They're destroying our family. They're promoting abortion. They're promoting all those kind of technology, would I say, method to reducing our birth rate. So now we are at, I don't know, in Sweden, we have a birth rate of 1.2. We need to have 2.1 to just sustain. And by this way, they are not openly on the street, maybe shooting us. They don't yet, but maybe they want to. but we have most of those, and they have a conspiracy to try to kill us. We can just listen to Barbara Lerner Spector. We can read the Calagra Plan, and we can also read this Barcelona Agreement, where they basically say that send over all your African immigrants to Europe. Just give us a free flow of oil, basically.
Right. Free oil? That's part of the Barcelona Agreement?
Not free, but you're getting the oil. Oh. You cannot restrict the supply of oil. But why do a nation like Sweden do that when you have a neighboring nation called Norway and go and get oil from them instead? So this is, I can't understand how stupid and pathetic the white race has become. Yeah. They are truly stupid and pathetic. And do they really have the? Do Yahweh really want to save such a people that are such a stupid and pathetic?
Well, that Moses dealt with that same issue when Yahweh said to Moses, "My people are so thick-headed and stupid that I think I'll just eliminate them all." And Moses, no, please don't do that. We deserve it. We do? Okay.
Okay, I have sympathy for Moses for experiencing this, because we are seeing it today with those our people. My, they.
Oh, man. Oh, yeah. It is. Yeah, it's almost, let me put it this way, it's almost a curse to be a member of the human race, okay, because there's so much delusion and stupidity. And, but of course, the main reason for it is the educational system created by the Jews dumbs us down to the point where we forget our history, we forget our origins, we forget science, mathematics, simple logic and reason, right? The Jews have done this to us.
Yeah,
the Jews have done this to it.
And one more method that they are doing it also that people don't even think about, but of course, technology is one of this part. Example, that if you want to go from A to B, instead of just knowing the way there, people today using the GPS. They can't even find their way today. They are so they wouldn't find their way home if the GPS system wouldn't work. Same with
right.
And we don't use example. Yeah. In Sweden, people don't use cash. they cannot even count. I give you 200. What should I get back if I have 100? Every kind of facet where you can use your own brain. People has just they've given away for the sake of technology. Technology is not your friend. Technology is not good because it makes your brain not working because you don't use your brain. If you don't use it, you lose it.
Yes, right. It's like when you go to McDonald's and the bill is, let's say, $2.51, and you give the clerk $3.01.
Yep.
And you have that confused look on their face.
What? Just 50 cents and I'm happy.
Yeah. Well, 301 minus 251 is 50 cents. Give me 50 cents. I want two quarters. I don't want 49 cents. I don't want a lot of pennies. Okay. But yeah, this will create confusion in the face of the clerk, you know, behind the register. You know, that's how uninformed, uneducated the people of the world have become thanks to globalism. Thanks to globalism, folks.
And look this. This is just basic stuff we're speaking of. Now, we are look at the spiritual side of what we are speaking about. And then the percentage is really shrinking fast.
Uh-huh. Oh, man. Yeah, well, but again, this creates a problem for the Jewish world order because the fewer number of people, especially white people, that are around in order to keep the gears turning, the technical gears turning, including those of AI, you know, you're asking for trouble. It's got a built-in, I don't know if the fail-safe is the correct term, but it's got built-in flaws because you're eliminating the people who are capable of actually making it work, right, and keeping it running. So this is what do you call unforeseen circumstances, unintended consequences of the New World Order, and it's going to bite them in the butt. It sure will. All right, so let's get into the Balfour Declaration, the what has been termed the stab in the back by various, especially Germany. The Balfour Declaration was a stab in the back of Germany because it betrayed the German people after World War I. So do you want to start or should I hear?
Do you want to start
Balfour
up?
Declaration? Okay, I'll start. All right, the Balfour Declaration and its consequences. Now, of course, we will never get an in-depth, although I think there are exposés of how the Jews orchestrated World War I from even before the World War I happened, and I know there are such documents, but they're very difficult to come by, very difficult to come by. But as we do this series, I'll see if I can find that, and because it's very clear that the Jews had planned World War I, the grabbing of Palestine, the stabbing in the back of Germany after World, and the stabbing in the back of Russia. All that was planned ahead of time. In the early 1900s and even before, so that all of these nations, so that the Jews could restructure the nations, especially in the Middle East, to foment future wars, okay? And that's the Balkanization of the Middle East and total control of the Middle East by, number one, the Jewish International, and by Great Britain, primarily by Great Britain, and the so-called British Mandate. And, of course, the peace treaty at Versailles, which was a total abomination. The peace treaty at Versailles was an absolute abomination, creating injustice, future injustice, guaranteeing future wars. Let me just put it that way, okay? So, today, what is the date of this? The 1st November 2017 by Avi Schleim. Today, November 1st, 2017, marks the 100-year anniversary of the Balfour Declaration. Here we present an essay by Avi Schleim. I don't know if I got a Jew or an Arab, that examines the Declaration and its historiography. And Palestine for the Jews, it's an insert here, official sympathy. Mr. Balfour has sent the following letter to Lord Rothschild in regard to the establishment of a national home in Palestine for the Jewish people. And most of it's cut off here. I have much pleasure in conveying to you, blah, blah, blah. The rest of it's cut off. So the question I would ask you, Michael, what right do the Jewish people, who did not even have a nation at the time of the Balfour Declaration, they had an organization called Zionism, and what right does the country of Britain have to start reshaping the map of the Middle East for any reason at all? Question to you, Michael.
No rights at all. Besides, probably the Rothschild was very rich. They had money, so they bought it. They blackmailed them, or they bought it with money.
Yes, this has everything to do with money, right? Yeah. So, the Jewish people have been redefining themselves throughout history anyway, okay? In the 19th century up to the 20th century, the Jews freely admitted that they were a people without a nation, okay? And that was the motivation behind Zionism, the pretense that they are Israelites, and therefore the creation of a Jewish state in Palestine would be, quote-unquote, the return of the Israelites back to Palestine. Well, of course, we know that they're not Israelites. Neither the Sephardic Jews nor the Ashkenazi Jews are Israelites. So there's no question of a return. That's false language. Okay, but legalese, it doesn't matter. False language is false language. If you can accept if you can get the international community to accept this false language, you've won a false legal victory. But that we're still living with this false legal victory today, folks. And I think you could safely say, Michael, that all of the problems in the world today go into the application, implementation of the Balfour Declaration in Palestine in 1948, and even before, okay? There has been nothing but strife on this planet, nothing but war, constant war, and cultural conflict between Arab and Jew, Jew versus American, etc., etc., since the Balfour Declaration was conceived and ratified by, it wasn't even ratified by the Parliament of England, as far as I know. It was just the cabinet and signed by Arthur Balfour and Lord Rothschild. So a Jew and a politician. That's the sole legitimacy of this declaration. You have a comment there.
No, just again, they are not. They cannot make this kind of decision. This is just right. Because they think they own the world because they think money. If you have money, you can do whatever you want, and this is what they try to do now too. To when they both Palestine, both this bastard state of Israel, because calling it Israel is also
it's a lie.
Because it's not. It's a lie. You can call it it's a lie or Kyrgyzstan, whatever, but it's not Israel.
Right. It's not Never. Israel. Thank you.
No, it's not.
Thank you very much. Yes. Okay, so let's continue here. Bernard, let's see. Okay, let me read this again. Today marks the 100-year anniversary of the Balfour Declaration, the statement that put the weight of the British Empire behind the establishment of a Jewish national homeland in Palestine. Now, I'm curious, who was the reigning monarch in Britain when the Balfour Declaration was declared? Because under what pretext was it, you know, how could the British Empire guarantee to the Jews a national home in a country that is not owned by them? Right? Who was the monarch? Did a monarch actually approve of this? Or was the British cabinet and the Zionists simply forcing their will upon England? I think it's actually the latter. Okay, they were forcing their will upon the nation of England. Okay, let's continue. Bernard Reagan's New History, the Balfour Declaration, Empire, the Mandate and Resistance in Palestine, is out now in the UK and on sale in North America on December 5th. Below, we present an essay by Avi Schleim that examines the Declaration and its historiography, excerpted from the book Israel and Palestine, Reappraisals, Revisions, and Refutations. Now, I could say, Michael, that reevaluations may occur in the intellectual sphere by certain authors, but getting the Jews to reevaluate the Balfour Declaration is another matter.
They,
right?
Come on, they, no. Yeah. They will not do it.
They'll never. The open discussion of this matter on any political forum, it will never happen, folks. That's why we, the people, have to force the issue and demand that the Jews prove, number one, that they're Israel, okay? Number two, that the Balfour Declaration has any authority whatsoever, since it basically says to one country, Palestine, that you must submit to Jewish emigration whether you like it or not. Oh, you know what? That's happening in Europe now. You must submit to non-white emigration into your countries whether you like it or not. All right, folks. This is genocide, as we've been talking about. Yeah, go ahead.
And a comment then. I looked up who was the monarch in Great Britain during this time. Was it George V? George Frederick Ernest Albert.
Okay, George V. Now, is he the one who abdicated? Because he was actually
The later one. There was the later one that abdicated. Okay. 36.
Okay.
So no, it was not him. It was Edward. Okay. That was Edward the Eighth, I think. But George V. He didn't abdicate. He sat on the throne in 25 years.
Okay, so George V. So it'd be interesting to find out what his view of the Balfour Declaration was. That would be interesting to find out. So let me make a note of that. So George V. Okay, so let's continue. Occasionally, there are topics that have been written about at such length that it helps us to clear the air or to establish a vantage point from which to consider the subject anew. Yeah, it definitely needs to be reevaluated, okay? We know that the international community is not going to reevaluate. Well, here, because we were just been talking about the United Nations. And the United Nations essentially created itself, right? Right after World War II. Claiming that it would be an instrument of peace, no more wars after the creation of the United Nations and blah, 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 right? But one of the first things the United Nations organization did was to create the Israeli state.
Yeah, that bastard. And I searched in the article here, and just this is Wikipedia, but it said something about Balfour Declaration regarding to George V.
Okay.
Read here. In 1926, George hosted an imperial conference in London at which the Balfour Declaration accepted the growth of the British dominions into self-governing autonomous communities within the British Empire, equal in status, in no way subordinate one to another.
Okay, read that again, because is it saying that the newly formed Israeli state would be an independent nation equal in status to Britain?
I can read it again. In 1926, George hosted an imperial conference in London at which the Balfour Declaration accepted the growth of the British dominions into self-governing, quote, autonomous communities within the British Empire, equal in status, in no way subordinate one to another.
Okay. So it sounds like George V is saying that all of our colonies are now independent states. Well, that would include then Israel, which would be regarded as an independent state. That's what the language sounds like to me. Okay,
yeah.
But it also sounds more like blah, 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 right? It's just more blah, blah, blah. by George V. So it sounds to me like George, go ahead.
I can read here too, is from the other article about it. The conclusion of the Imperial Conference of 1926 were restated by the 1930 Conference and incorporated in the Statutes of Westminster of December 1931. In the statute, the British Parliament provided that it would not enact a law which applied to a dominion as part of the law of that dominion, unless the law expressly stated that the Dominion government had requested and consented to the enactment of the law. Doesn't tell me on much, but...
Right. Well, it sounds like under George V, the British government abdicated from colonialism. That's what it sounds like. Okay. So whatever the British Empire was before this date, it no longer was that, okay? That's what it's, I've never heard of this. This is a very interesting development under George V. I think they want to keep this swept under the rug, okay? So but it sounds like this is the end of the British Empire, really, okay? But nevertheless, the money power behind the British Empire still remains as the ruling power. Very interesting. The ramifications of that decision are very interesting. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, that was the article. That's what I read. So it's, that was about it.
Okay. Yeah, so that bears further investigation. Was this an actual abdication of empire by Britain? It's what it sounds like. Okay. Anyway, so let's continue here. Okay, so I propose to focus on the declaration itself, on the motives behind it, the way it was implemented, the conflicts to which it gave rise. Boy, has it given rise to conflicts, folks. Just about every war on the planet is a result of this Balfour Declaration, and on its consequences for Britain's position as the paramount Western power in the Middle East. I begin with a note on the background. Now, of course, what you just read suggests that George V was declaring the British Empire no longer in effect.
Yeah, right? And that can can that make sense? Because, the Jews now felt now their empire, they won't have anyone interfering with their empires. Now, they were done with the British Empire. That was their vehicle for years since Rothschild's start until the end of the First World War.
Yeah. Yeah, and Paul Eric says that was when Britain sold out to the Jew. Right?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So... Yeah, this is very interesting. I mean, most people simply do not pay any attention to these international documents, right? No attention whatsoever. But it's very important, especially the Balfour Declaration, needs to be evaluated for what it really is. And it is nothing but a power grab by the Zionists of whatever nation they can grab. Okay, and Palestine would be the number one grabby, but also Germany, Russia, Turkey, and Austria, various nations who were affected by the Balfour Declaration and World War One itself, and of course the peace treaty at Versailles, an absolute abomination of Jewish statesmanship. Because the Jews controlled that conference from beginning to end, okay, including our president Woodrow Wilson, who was handled by another Jew advisor in his Colonel House, a Jew who started the tradition of presidents having Jewish advisors in the White House, right? So that tradition was started under Woodrow Wilson. It continues today. So let's continue. Occasionally, there are,
British imperialism.
Okay. Right. British imperialism in the Middle East during the First World War was, to use a British understatement, intricate. it was an abomination. In 1915, Britain promised Hussein, the Sharif of Mecca, that it would support an independent Arab kingdom under his rule in return for his mounting an Arab revolt against the Ottoman Empire, Germany's ally in the war. Now, listen to this, folks. This is so important. A promise. I mean, you can say history is a record of broken promises by governments. That's history, folks. Broken promises by government. You know, thousands of them. Let me repeat this. This is a very important statement. British imperialism, that's the next sentence. In 1915, Britain, this was like 2 years before the Balfour Declaration. In 1915, Britain promised Hussein, the Sharif of Mecca, that it would support an independent Arab kingdom under his rule in return for his mounting an Arab revolt against the Ottoman Empire, Germany's ally in the war. So we can see that there was a side thrust here against Germany, okay? But Lawrence of Arabia, who was a Brit, fought on the Arab side in anticipation of this promise being kept. Do you think Lawrence of Arabia was disappointed when it was not kept?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Boy, he was infuriated. He was absolutely infuriated. And, history doesn't tell that story because the Jews won the war, right? The victors write the textbooks, the history books, okay? So this is the promise given to – go ahead.
Yeah, and I just want to quote Napoleon, because Napoleon said that history is a set of lies agreed upon.
Yeah, right. That is correct, okay? All right, let's continue. The promise was contained in a letter dated 24 October 1915 from Sir Henry McMahon, the British High Commissioner in Egypt, to the Sharif of Mecca in what later became known as the McMahon-Hussein correspondence. Now, what is the Balfour Declaration but a correspondence between a Jew and a high-ranking British official? Okay, so how does one overrule the other?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Yeah. The Sharif of Mecca assumed that the promise included Palestine. Oh, no. The Arabs were living there, right?
Yeah.
But never assume. You make sure you get that in writing, Sharif. Get that in writing. In 1916, Britain reached a secret agreement with France to divide the Middle East into spheres of influence in the event of an Allied victory. So we have promise after promise after promise, none of which were kept. Under the terms of the Sykes-Picot Agreement, Palestine was to be placed under international control. Now, that's not what the Sharif of Mecca was expecting, was it?
No.
Okay.
No, he didn't.
No, these agreements are nothing but blah, blah, blah. In 1917, Britain issued the Balfour Declaration, promising to support the establishment of a national home for the Jewish people in Palestine, also contradicting the agreement, made with the Sharif of Mecca. So, I mean, talk about bad faith coming from the British Empire. But we know the British Empire has been ruled by the Jewish moneylenders since 1694. So what do you expect from any agreement that the British Empire proposes? Okay, it's going to be violated. Let's continue. Okay, yeah, you were going to say something there, Michael?
No, if you want, I can read on.
Okay, yeah, go ahead. All right.
So, by a stroke of the imperial pen, the promised land became twice promised. Yeah, twice promised.
Twice bait. Right. Who gets it? Spin the dial. See who gets it.
Even by the standards of perfidious Albion, this was an extraordinary tale of double dealing and betrayal. A tale that continued to haunt Britain throughout the 30 years of his rule in Palestine.
Oh, for sure. I mean, you make the conflicting promises to two groups of people. What do you expect?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Please continue.
Of the three wartime pledges, the most curious and certainly the most controversial was the Balfour Declaration. Here, wrote Arthur Koestler, was one nation promising another nation the land of a third nation. Koestler dismissed the declaration as an impossible notion, an unnatural graft. A white Negro, okay, C.P. Scott, the ardently pro-Zionist editor of the Manchester Guardian, played a significant part in persuading the British government to issue the declaration. In an editorial article, Scott hailed the declaration as an act of imaginative generosity.
I really like the way Koestler, he described it as an unnatural graft, a white Negro. Right. An impossibility, folks.
Yeah.
Please continue.
Yeah. It is at once the fulfillment of aspiration, the signpost of destiny. Elizabeth Monroe in Britain's moment in the Middle East conceded that to the Jews who went to Palestine, the declaration signified fulfillment and salvation. But she also noted that to the British, the declaration brought much ill will and complications that sapped their strength.
Do you think the Jews care if this declaration brought ill will to Britain?
No, they didn't care. They thought about themselves.
That's exactly right. Please continue.
Measured by British interest alone, argued Monroe, it is one of the greatest mistakes in our imperial history. Oh, yeah, it is.
Amen. Amen to that. Amen. All right. So we're getting some historical truth here, folks. Can you believe it? All right. Please continue.
Yeah, and look now how big that mistake has been. I mean, she's gone by long ago. Yes, look at the past history about that place down there.
Right. Yeah. That bastard state called Israel. All right.
Yeah, where do the kikes live?
Where do the kikes go? Where do the kikes go? All right.
On 2nd November 1917, Arthur Balfour, Britain's Secretary of State for Foreign Affairs, addressed a letter to Lord Rothschild, one of the leaders of the British Jews, as follows. Yeah, leaders of the British Jews, because he was the richest one. He is then the leader.
Right.
I have much pleasure in conveying to you, on behalf of His Majesty's government, the following declarations of sympathy, which has been submitted to and approved by the Cabinet. His Majesty's government view with favor the establishment in Palestine of a natural home for the Jewish people and will use their best endeavors to facilitate the achievements of this object. It being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious right of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine or the rights and political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country.
Okay, let me underline this one section. And it being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine. Has this provision of the Declaration ever been upheld?
No.
No. The Palestinians had nothing to say about it. Their rights have been absolutely crushed under this document.
May you
absolutely
see them?
Crushed.
Yeah. Can we say here you see the Jewish chutzpah?
That's right, chutzpah. Yeah, it's the Balfour. It should be the chutzpah declaration, All right. The Chutzpah Declaration. All right. Please continue.
And this short text here is never read in the schools. Why doesn't the school read this, Eli? Do you wonder?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, because the contradictions are self-evident within it. Okay? You can't make this public. By all intents and purposes, it's a secret agreement between the richest Jew in England and the politicians under his control, monetary control. That's all this is. Okay. I hired you. You know, I control you. I want you to sign this document. I'm sure it was prepared by Rothschild himself. And then Balfour pretended to compose it. Back to you.
Yeah, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Or he was dictating it to his ear what to write.
That's right. Exactly.
The statement was exceedingly brief, consisting of mere 67 words, but its consequences were both profound and pervasive, and its impact on the subsequent history of the Middle East was nothing less than revolutionary.
Not to mention the whole world, because since the Israeli state was created, there's been nothing but war. Nothing but war instigated by the Jews of Israel.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It completely transformed the position of the fledgling Zionist movement vis-a-vis the Arabs of Palestine, and it provided a protective umbrella that enables the Zionists to proceed steadily toward their ultimate goal of establishing an independent Jewish state in Palestine. Rarely in the annals of the British Empire has such a short document produced such a far-reaching consequences. In view of its political impact, it is not surprising that the Balfour Declaration has attracted so much attention from historians of the Middle East.
Stop right there. Attention. How much public discussion are you aware of regarding the Balfour Declaration?
None.
Absolutely none. This document is, by all intents and purposes, a secret document because it is never discussed. Back to you.
No, I haven't read about this. When I got in indoctrination years in school, they never told me about this. I have to dig up this myself when I was done with everything. I thought I never stopped learning. So then I read this. Oops, this has some consequence. Yeah.
Not even a footnote.
No, not even a footnote. No.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. Nor is it surprising that almost a century later, it remains such a contentious and controversial subject. There are several bones of contentions in this debate, all of them revolving around the question of compatibility between the three wartime agreements.
Uh-huh.
The questions of conflict between Britain promises to Sharif Hussein and to the French. The most definitely study is by Eli Kedouri. Kedouri was the first scholar to bring together all the available evidence from British, French, and Arabic sources to elucidate the meaning of the Makhachun-Hussein correspondence and examine its impact on British policy between the wars.
Yeah, that's McMahon slash Hussein. McMahon being the Brit, Hussein being the Arab.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
His principal conclusion is that the
Sykes-Picot agreement, that's between the French and the British, a separate agreement. Okay, please continue.
Did not violate the commitments contained in the Mahon-Hussein correspondence.
Really? I would not have concluded that. I'd say there's tremendous conflict in making a territorial promise to the same territory to two different groups.
Mm-hmm.
I'd say that's got conflict built into it. All right.
The Balfour Declaration, however, is only mentioned by Ken Dury in passing because it falls outside the scope of this study.
Okay, yeah, keep it secret.
In 1916, the Sharif of Mecca proclaimed himself king of the Arab countries, but the Allies recognized him only as king of the Hejaz. On the relationship between Britain's commitment to the Zionists and to King Hussein, the most recent study is conditional and non-binding, and that, in any case, it did not include Palestine. Friedman argues not only that Sir Henry had definitely excluded Palestine from the prospective Arab kingdom, but that this was understood by the Hashemitic leader at the time.
Okay, and I just looked up the word Hejaz, and that simply refers to a region of Saudi Arabia, which would not include Palestine. So, was this not in writing that it disregarded Palestine and not just Saudi Arabia? Okay, mm-hmm. Folks, I mean, you have to be specific in your agreements. All right, back to you.
And this Hashemite leaders, is that a Jewish group?
I missed that. What's the name of the group?
Hashemite leaders, or is that something else? Maybe
I haven't heard that. Hashemite. Okay, I think that's probably an Arab group.
Ah, it could be.
Okay, so let me read it. Friedman argues not only that Sir Henry had definitely excluded Palestine from the prospective Arab kingdom, but that this was understood by the Hashemite leader at the time. So he's saying that the Arabs understood that Palestine was not included? I don't know about that. Why would Lawrence of Arabia fight for Palestine if they had agreed that Palestine is not included? That does not make any sense. Okay, back to you.
Hussein's silence following the publication of the Balfour Declaration is seen by Friedman as indicative of his attitude. Another piece of evidence cited by Friedman comes famous book by George Antonius, the spokesman and chronicler of the Arab National Movement. From Antonius, we learn that King Hussein ordered his sons to do what they could to ally the apprehension caused by the Balfour Declaration among their followers, and dispatched an emissary to Faisal at Aqaba with similar instructions.
So was he bribed? Was he paid off to betray Palestine? Is that what Friedman is trying to say? It's possible. Okay. King Hussein, quote, ordered his sons to do what they could to allay the apprehensions caused by the Balfour Declaration among their followers and dispatched an emissary to Faisal at Aqaba with similar instructions. But what were those instructions? To abandon Palestine? Again, this is not clear. All right, back to you.
Friedman's conclusion is that the charges of fraudulence and deceptive leveling against the British after the war were largely groundless. Groundless or not, these charges acquired the status of dogma, not only in the eyes of Arab nationalists, but, more surprisingly, in the eyes of most British officials as well. In the case
including Lawrence of Arabia. Mm-hmm. Okay.
In the case of King Hussein, it is necessary to distinguish much more clearly than Friedman does between his initial response to the Balfour Declaration and his subsequent attitude. When news of the declaration reached Hussein, he was greatly disturbed by it and asked Britain to clarify its meaning. Withhall met this request with the dispatch of Commander D.J. Hogarth, one of the head of the Arab Bureau in Cairo, who arrived in Jeddah in the first week of January 1918, for a series of interviews with King Hussein. Hogartha's message, as it came to be known, reaffirmed the Entente's determination that the Arab race shall be given full opportunity at once again, forming a nation in the world.
Okay, so hold on, hold on. So Hogarth's message reaffirmed the Entente's determination that, quote, the Arab race shall be given full opportunity of once again forming a nation in the world, unquote, but it does not mention Palestine. Okay, so where should these Arabs reform? Where have the Palestinians ever been welcomed by any other nation?
No, not really.
No, they are the persona non grata of the world, folks. Back to you.
Yeah. So far as Palestine mm-hmm. was concerned, Britain was determined that no people shall be subjugated to another. Britain
okay.
noted and supported the aspiration of the Jews to return to Palestine, but only insofar as this was compatible with the freedom of existing population, both economic and political. Hussein voiced no disagreement with this policy, though we may be skeptical of Hogarth's report that he agreed enthusiastically with it.
I agree with that, yes. Okay, that's probably misrepresentation for sure. Okay.
Hogarth's message is crucial for understanding King Hussein's attitude to the Balfour Declaration. Following the meeting in Jeddah, Hussein thought he had Britain's assurance that the settlement of the Jews in Palestine would not conflict with Arab independence in that country.
Amen to that. How else could he possibly, unless he was paid off, would he betray his own people?
We have a lot of traitors within our ranks, within people's yeah. ranks, for
That's
the sake
for
of
sure.
money.
Yeah. But obviously, after the fact, King Hussein is saying, no, I didn't agree to that. Please continue.
This explains its initial silence in public and his private efforts to ally the anxieties of his sons. Hussein had great respect for the Jews, seeing them following the Quran as the people of the book.
Oh, okay. That was a big mistake.
Yeah.
All right.
Meaning the Bible. Yeah, if he would have seen that the British was the people of the Bible, maybe I would act differently.
Right. Amen.
He was not opposed to the settlement of Jews in Palestine and even welcomed it on religious and humanitarian grounds. He was, however, emphatically opposed to a Zionist takeover of the country. Hogarth gave him a solemn pledge that Britain would respect not only the economic but also the political freedom of the Arab population. When Britain subsequently refused to recognize Arab independence in Palestine, Hussein felt betrayed and accused Britain of breach of faith.
There you go. There you go. That's yeah. So the only reason he gave credence to the Jews at all was because he falsely assumed they were the people of the book. Okay? Wrong on all counts.
Yeah.
Please continue.
Do you want to take the last part now?
Yeah. Okay, very good. So if the disenchantment of Sharif Hussein and his sons with Britain was gradual, the hostility of the Arab nationalists toward Britain on account of the Balfour Declaration was immediate and unremitting, as we would expect. Okay, so suppose, Michael, that Britain had come to an agreement with the world Jewish community that Sweden would be given to them. How do you think the Swedes would react to that?
Maybe some reactions, but I'm so sorry. The Swedes are very collectivized, so I don't know how much you would.
Please don't say that. You would think the Swedes would be outraged. What right do you Brits and Jews have to take our country from us?
Maybe they could react, but I'm a bit negative towards the Swedes because of how they are. They are collectivized.
So sorry to hear that.
I know, but that's the sorry state of the socialistic.
It is a sorry state. It's a sorry state of the white race, actually.
Yeah, okay. It is.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay. So where was I? Next sentence here. One valuable Arabic source on this period is the diary of Ayuni Abd al-Hadi. Abd al-Hadi was a Palestinian politician who served as one of Amir Faisal's secretaries at the Paris Peace Conference and during his short-lived administration in Damascus in 1920. He then served Amir Abdullah, Faisal's elder brother, in Transjordan. In 1924, so we're talking about somebody who was there and saw it all happen. In 1924, he returned to Palestine and became one of the chief spokesmen of the Palestinian National Movement. Abd al-Hadi's impression was that Faisal resented the Zionist intrusion into Palestine, but was wary of upsetting the British. Okay. Yeah, caught between one behemoth and another. Faisal was also influenced, according to Abd al-Hadi, by reassuring letters he received from his father in the early months of 1918 in his camp in Aqaba on the subject of the Balfour Declaration. No, you can't be reassured about anything Jewish, right? Forget that noise. For his part, Abd al-Hadi did not believe in the possibility of cooperation with the Zionists in Palestine. Wise person, very wise. He was therefore very critical in his diary of Faisal for signing an agreement on Arab-Jewish cooperation with Dr. Chaim Weizmann at their meeting in Aqaba on 4 June 1919. What was he thinking?
Yeah.
What was he thinking? There's something here. There's something amiss here that is not being told. Okay? It's
bribery.
Possible that there you go. Even Abdi al-Hadi may not know of it. Okay? This is extremely... I smell a Jewish rat. A big Jewish rat. But he also notes that Faisal added a handwritten codicil making the implementation of the agreement conditional on his demands concerning Arab independence being fulfilled. Well, we know what that means to the Jews. Nothing. As these conditions were not fulfilled, the agreement became null and void. Okay, so he considered it to be not null and void, but that's not what the Jews thought, and that's not what the Brits thought. Okay. There are a number of other references to the Balfour Declaration in Ayuni Abd al-Hadi's diary, all of them highly critical of the British and of their Jewish protégés. Yeah, Jewish protégés. Well, no, actually, it's the other way around. The British are the protégés of the Jews handling the British in this case. His basic view, repeated on several occasions, was that the declaration was made by an English foreigner who had no ownership of Palestine to a foreign Jew who had no right to it. Amen to that. Palestine thus faced a double danger from the British mandate and from the Zionist movement. In December 1920, Abd al-Hadi participated in the Third Palestinian Congress in Haifa. The Congress denounced the actions of the British government and its plans for realizing the Zionist goals. It also rejected Balfour's promise of a national home for the Jews in Palestine as a violation of international law, of wartime Allied commitments, and of the natural rights of the inhabitants of the country. How can anybody disagree with this? Right? The Jews had no right to it, and the British had no right to it. In 1932, Abd al-Hadi founded the Palestinian branch of the Pan-Arab Independence Party, whose manifesto called for the cancellation of the mandate and of the Balfour Declaration. I've never heard of this conference, right? Calling for the cancellation of the mandate and the Balfour Declaration. Somehow, it found the memory hole, right? But not the light of day. This is the first I've heard of this. Arab hostility to the Balfour Declaration, as exemplified by Auni Abd al-Hadi, could have been predicted from the beginning. So why, hold on, pop-up just, so why was it issued? Because, can you tell us why it was issued, Michael?
The Balfour Declaration.
Yeah, why was it issued?
Because the Jews wanted Palestine.
Because the Jews wanted Palestine. That's the bottom line. All right. So they could pretend to be Israel, dupe the entire Judeo-Christian world into believing the Jews are Israel, etc., etc., etc. Okay. There are two main schools of thought on the origins of the Balfour Declaration. One represented by Leonard Stein, the other by Meir Verrete. What later became the conventional wisdom on the subject was first laid out by Stein in 1961 in his masterly survey, The Balfour Declaration. This book provides a careful, detailed, and subtle account of the decision-making process that led Britain to issue the declaration, but does not reach any clear-cut conclusions. All right. The conclusion implicit in the narrative, however, is that it was the activity and skill of the Zionists, and particular that Dr. Chaim Weizmann, that induced Britain to issue its famous statement of support for the Zionist cause. The Jews did it, folks. The Jews are behind it, as we suspected. Stein's book was subjected to an extended critique by Meir Verrete of the Hebrew University in Jerusalem in a notable article he published in 1970, entitled The Balfour Declaration and Its Makers. Okay, folks, so we're going to have to pick this up next week, and we will underline this. Folks, this is good. This really gives us the true history and the evil and perfidiousness of the Jews at work during the Balfour Declaration. Thank you, Michael. Take care, everybody. God bless everybody. See you next time. Bye-bye.
God bless you all.